tell you, but you know you can't mess with my mind.
Welcome to Economics and Beyond. I'm Rob Johnson, president of the Institute for New Economic Thinking.
But you know you can't mess with my mind.
So you can't kill my mind.
You know we'll go away.
We're gonna go away.
Come back, come back, come back,
come back.
My second time.
I'm here today with Seth Klein, who for over 20 years served as the director of the British Columbia office for the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives. I believe you were the founding director, in fact, which was Canada's foremost social justice think tank. He now works as a freelance policy consultant, and he's an adjunct professor at Simon Fraser University in their urban studies program. We're here today to talk about whatever he wants to talk about, including his sister, Naomi Klein, who's a good friend of mine and a good friend of Inet's. But in particular, he's written what I think is an extraordinary book called A Good War, Mobilizing Canada for the Climate Emergency. Seth, thanks for joining me today.
Hi, Rob.
So here we are talking in December. You finished your book, turned it in, and then lo and behold, a pandemic emerged.
Yeah.
There are all kinds of ideas. There are all kinds of things. But I find your book extraordinary because it brings historical analogies, ways in which in the past people have changed their modus operandi and all kinds of things. But let's start first with, what do you see in this world of this pandemic? What are you, how would I say, affirming? What do you think is hideous? What are you not seeing you wish you'd saw? And then we'll talk about how that it impinges upon the agenda of climate transformation on planet
Earth.
Yeah,
sure. Well, I mean, before speaking directly of the pandemic, I should say, you know, the book is about mobilizing Canada for the climate emergency. It's all structured around lessons from the Second World War. That's why it's called The Good War. And I had shipped it off for final copy edit 3 days before the pandemic, which was some awkward timing, I'll tell you. The whole premise of the book was that we needed this historic reminder of how quickly we're capable of pivoting and retooling the economy once we recognize an emergency as an emergency. I thought we needed the historic reminder, but of course, here we all are living this in real time. Now, I mean, my reflections are, I'm in Canada, so I'll offer my reflections about the parallels that I see. Certainly in the first wave, as many of your listeners will know, the Canadian government handled the first wave a lot better than in the United States. We managed to get the curve well bent and our numbers very low. We've handled the second wave less well. And it's, you know, when it comes to mobilizing for the climate emergency, it's a good news, bad news story. The bad news is that momentum for climate action was really building in Canada up until the pandemic. In September a year ago, there were those global action days that the students and young people had called for. We had 1 million people on the streets in Canada, you know, which was the largest single day of political protest in Canadian history, as near as I can tell. The opinion polling, things were really moving. And the pandemic, of course, moves everything else off the front burner for now, for obvious reasons. But I do feel like it sets us up well in some important ways for what we now need to do in the face of what is, in fact, a more significant threat. For us, I think just a sense of social solidarity is at a generational high. Cooperation across party lines and across confederations at a generational high. People's willingness to listen to science is at a high point. But even bigger than that, people's appreciation of the role of government and public services. These are all things that set us up well, I think, for what we now need to do.
But how would I say? The pandemic obviously teaches us that we can infect each other or going out and hanging out without a mask puts your family at risk when you come home, and various things like that. So there's a, in the old famous poem of Muhammad Ali, which I once read was the shortest poem according, the shortest poem in history according to the Guinness Book of World Records, where Muhammad Ali said, "Me, we." Well, there's a whole lot more "we" in our consciousness than there was, at least in the United States, which had a "me" fixation. But how would I say? I've had people on this podcast, some of whom have said people are going to be exhausted by the pandemic. They won't want to change or transform anything more. We'll have used up a lot of fiscal capacity, and this is going to damage or retard our embracing the challenge of climate change.
Well, maybe.
On the other side, people say, no. This is teaching us a big lesson. I'm curious where you're at. How do you see
Well, it? I see that it could go either way. Like every historic moment, both of those lessons are possible. I mean, what the war and the pandemic and the climate emergency all have in common is that they're collective action problems, and the solutions are collective. We have a new sense of our responsibility towards one another. They all wrestle with how to get people to think in collective terms in those ways. It's true that, you know, if, particularly in this second wave, there's this fatigue that sets in, and that's challenging. But I think one of the things that is different about the climate emergency and the war on the one hand and the pandemic on the other, the things we're required to do in the face of the pandemic go against all of our social instincts, right? The order to isolate. And the good news is the climate emergency calls on us to do the opposite, to get out and do something grand together. So that's good. Then there's the matter you're raising around fiscal capacity. And I hear that too. People saying, you know, we've had to ramp up spending so much in the face of the pandemic. Now we won't, you know, the cupboard will be bare for the climate emergency. That's possible, but I'm choosing to believe that we will draw the opposite lesson. Again, I'm drawing on the Canadian experience, but we have seen certainly the largest ramp up in federal government spending since the Second World War. Almost all of it has been financed by our central bank, by the Bank of Canada, which from the beginning of the pandemic was buying up $5 billion in government securities a week. That may not sound super large to an American audience, but that's real big for us. And in many respects, I think the cat's out of the bag now. You know, after being told for years that the money wasn't there to tackle homelessness and poverty and the climate emergency, the Bank of Canada and the federal government has just shown us what was possible all along when we actually recognize emergencies for what they are.
I look at the, how would I say, we can't afford it arguments. They really don't, hold up now. I know a number of people in the macroeconomic realm have argued for this, what they call modern monetary theory, mm-hmm. and have tried to unmask the false consciousness of scarcity for a long time. But the, I guess
there's no doubt that the pandemic has given new legs to modern monetary theory. It's done more to help the case in the last 10 months than the last 20 years.
Yeah. Well, I look at it now, and I guess, as you said, you started your book before. So before the pandemic taught us lessons or even created inspiration, you became inspired to use this war analogy. And I remember you early on in your book, you quoted a guy named William Reese, and he's a professor at UBC, I believe, British Columbia. And he said something like, the ecologically necessary is politically infeasible, but the politically feasible is ecologically not up to the task or irrelevant. And so the question that I thought was fascinating is, instead of getting caught in what Naomi Oreskes calls the merchants of doubt. Accepting the science, seeing the danger on the horizon, you approached what you might call the challenge, not of thinking big, but of doing big, I think, and I'm quoting you from an earlier presentation I heard you make on a podcast. Thinking big to doing big. Doing big means changing a lot of habits, like you said, collective action. But where did you get when did the light bulb go off where you had that insight that you, wanted to focus on the politics and the war as an analogy of how to do it?
Well, when I set about to write the book, it was always going to be primarily a political endeavor. But it was not originally going to be a book about the war. When I originally set out to do this, I was riffing off that quote from William Rees, and I was trying to tackle what do we do about this harrowing gap between what the science says we have to do and what our politics seems prepared to entertain. And I wanted to write something that would seek to embolden our politicians to be more daring than they've been to date in the face of the emergency. In the original book outline, I had a single chapter on lessons from the Second World War. You know, I'd written an essay about that before, and I'd long been intrigued by the example of the Second World War of rapid economic retooling. And I wanted to dig into that a little bit more. But then as I started to dig into it, I started to see more and more parallels. And they weren't just on the economic front. They related to how public opinion was marshaled then and lessons for now. The relationship between inequality and mobilization then and now. In the Canadian context, how do you navigate all the intricacies of confederation and federal-provincial relations then and now? The role of Indigenous people then and now? The role of youth then and now? How did we pay for it then and now? What did we do for returning soldiers? And is there a model there for just transition for fossil fuel workers today? And it was a couple months into the project that I realized I just had that light bulb moment and decided to completely rewrite the outline and structure the whole thing around lessons from the Second World War. Because not only because of those parallels, but a couple other reasons as well. One is because I was increasingly finding it this very helpful and hopeful reminder that, you know, for all of us who have this question in the back of our minds all the time when we think about climate, can we really do what we have to do at the speed and scale required? The answer from the World War II story is, yeah, we can, because we did. We've done it. In fact, we did it twice. In Canada's case, you know, we entered the war 2 years earlier, and so it was a six-year war. And in the space of those 6 years, we completely retooled the economy to ramp up military production. And then we had to reconvert everything back to a peacetime economy. So it happened twice. But I also found in the course of writing, and I've especially appreciated as since the book has come out, and I've been talking a lot and doing a lot of events and interviews, so many of us have a connection to the World War II story. And the book becomes a framework to engage different audiences from different institutions to say, you know, these people in our not so distant past who you admire, who provide a kind of sense of legacy and purpose to you, this is what they did in the face of an emergency. Now, who do you want to be today?
How would I say, the particular application to Canada is fascinating. Like you said, it was war before the United States. It transformed the economy. And now, I think you told me that Canada's the sixth largest producer of oil and the fourth largest producer of natural gas in the world. So you're right up in the front row with the U.S., Russia, and the Middle East. That means you have to transform your economy more than most places because they aren't on the production side of what has to be curtailed. They have to change their consumption, transportation systems, and all that. It's a big job everywhere, but particularly in Canada, both the supply and demand sides need major
surgery.
That's right.
About 25% of Canada's emissions, domestic emissions,
are from the extraction of, and production of fossil fuels. And so that, of course, doesn't count everything we export, and that counts towards somebody else's emissions, you know, and our role as the peddlers of this stuff. But we got to get our house in order. And it's a big job, particularly there's a lot of heavy lifting for certain regions of the country. I mean, writ large, the oil and gas industry is not a massive piece of Canada's economy and employment. But in the provinces of Alberta and Saskatchewan and Newfoundland, it's huge. And so they got some real heavy lifting to do. You know, when you talk about climate with Canadians, often, very often, the argument comes up, oh, well, we're just so little. You know, even if we were to do everything on this front, what would it really matter? And so the points I try to make are, first of all, the ones you've just made. We are major producers of oil and gas and exporters of this stuff. Our per capita emissions are among the highest in the world and higher than in the United States. But again, I've ever since the release of this book, I've become like everyone. It's an odd uncle who brings everything back to the war, back in the war. I do like the fact that I get to point out to people that in the war, we didn't wait on the Americans. We entered 2 years earlier, and we were an even smaller country then. We were less than a third the size we are today. We were a country of 11 million people. We spent the first 2 years as really the only country in the Western Hemisphere engaged in that fight. And at the end of the war, nobody questioned the value of our contributions. And I think that, you know, that's a reminder to Canadians that they take some pride in, and again, an opening to talk about what role we want to play today.
Well, there are what I'll call objective and structural challenges that are different in different places. But the other thing I know, because you've been a speaker at INET conferences, particularly our plenary in Berlin, I remember, is that ideas, habits of what is appropriate behavior and so forth can also be, which you might call, a source of resistance to rising to a new challenge. And I'm curious how you see what you might call how we're being weaned from neoliberalism and what role that plays in the, what you might call, the pathway to sufficient action.
Well, I believe that neoliberalism and the legacy of 40 years of neoliberalism has been one of the key things holding us back from doing what we need to do. And the zombie ideas of neoliberalism are one of the barriers to change that we're confronting. You know, when I've been asked, I end up getting asked in almost every interview, how do you know when a government is in emergency mode? And I end up offering these four markers of when you know. This is, Rob, forgive me, this is going to be a bit of a roundabout way of answering your question. But the four markers of emergency mode are: you spend what it takes to win, you create new economic institutions to get the job done, you move from voluntary and incentive-based policies to mandatory measures as required, and you tell the truth about the severity of the crisis. Now, when I think about those four markers,
necessity is the mother of invention.
Yeah, exactly. Now, when I think of those four markers, we did all of those things in the war. So did you in the U.S. When I think about those four markers with respect to the pandemic, my federal government has done hits all four markers. But when it comes to the climate emergency, we hit none of them. Now, why is that? Why are we not spending what we need to spend to actually rise to this moment? Why are we not creating audacious new programs and new crown corporations, what we call crown corporations, you call public enterprises, to get the job done? Why do we approach everything voluntary? Like when I look at all the federal and provincial climate actions to date, and this drives why we've made so little progress, they're all voluntary. We incentivize change. We encourage change. We give rebates. We send price signals. What we decidedly don't do is require. We don't use the regulatory power of the state to require change, and we don't tell the truth about the need to wind down the fossil fuel industries. Why is it that we aren't doing these things? It is the legacy of neoliberalism that rules all of those things as somehow off limits or no longer allowed. And so that's a barrier. But the most insidious barrier, I think, of 40 years of, or the most insidious legacy, I should say, of 40 years of neoliberalism is the sapping of our ambition, is the sapping of our belief in our collective ability to do grand things together. And that's part of what I'm trying to excavate from our World War II story.
I guess the other things that I think about is barriers rather than ideological. Say, let's take the financial crisis of 2008. And I'm speaking now from a United States reference point, but a lot of people thought, well, finance had the wrong model. Financial regulation messed up. We bailed these guys out. But once we put that back together, we'll be back on the road. What we saw was a combination of Occupy on the left, Tea Party on the right, a strong consensus of corruption, a deterioration in the faith in governance and expertise that, how would I say, permeated, or at the beginning was centered on finance, but it tended to erode that confidence in all sectors of governance and expertise, including things like climate science. So I see now we're in a place where you're advocating collective action. And the people on the right who don't like government have had what you might call plenty of fodder for their gun to aim at the inefficiencies, the corruptions, the refractory nature of government. But like you said moments ago, with the four indicators, you gotta rise above all of that. You gotta go get it done.
Naomi talks about how we meet the climate crisis at a very unfortunate time with the legacy of neoliberalism, and that our faith in public institutions is at this low point just when we most need it. And certainly the 2008-9 crisis didn't help matters. But, you know, to circle back to the opening of our conversation, I think in some important ways, maybe more so in Canada than the United States, the pandemic does the opposite. It begins the process of restoring our faith in public institutions. But part of what I'm arguing in the book is you never know when a particular government or party or institution is able to rise to a challenge in a time of emergency. Like if you had said to Canadians in 1938, the year before we declared war, does the Mackenzie King government and his cabinet, who are our government in World War II, you know, do they have it within them to completely transform the Canadian economy and mobilize society? I'm pretty sure most Canadians would have said, no, not that gang. They don't think that way. And if you had asked me 10 months ago, if I thought that there were the people in the federal Ministry of Finance and our, you know, our Bank of Canada, your equivalent of the Federal Reserve, are the people there who can quickly pivot and create audacious new programs like we have seen in terms of our wage subsidy and emergency benefits and so on, you know, I probably cynically would have told you, not probably, I definitely would have cynically told you no, that there's no one home who thinks that way. And I would have been wrong. So you never know whether or not when people get, and incidentally, you know, part of what's intriguing for me about Canada and our World War II story is we never had a New Deal in Canada the way you did. There were people who wanted it, but that same Mackenzie King government couldn't get unlocked from, you know, what we today would call neoliberal thinking. It took the war, and then everything was liberated, and their thinking was liberated. So the question is simply what, you know, the question with all of these things is, what is the combination of the right people with the right kind of leadership and events that allow us to truly pivot into emergency mode? And will it come in time? And we don't know if it'll come in time. That's the ambivalent time in which we live.
Well, one of the things that's concerned me is that in addition to that neoliberal context, we've also experienced a great deal of concentration in income and wealth, meaning exacerbated inequality quite a lot in the 3 decades prior to the onset of this challenge, or I guess the onset of the challenge that we may undertake now that we should have started long ago. But I hear lots of people being concerned about how addressing climate, things like carbon taxes, what have you, are going to exacerbate inequality. And some cite the French experience, the yellow vests, and the reaction. But I know from reading some of your past work, the notion of a carbon tax and a carbon dividend, and in context with a Green New Deal, how do you see what you might call ways of addressing climate without exacerbating inequality? Because that exacerbated inequality, given where we already are, is frightening. And how do we alleviate that fear with a more constructive trajectory?
Yeah. Well, so much of my book actually deals with the intersection of inequality and climate action. And there's certainly, I'm so glad this has come up, Rob. So there are all these climate policy purists out there who say, don't link climate action to inequality. You know, this is complicated enough as it is. Don't weigh it down with all of these other social justice-y considerations. And I respectfully think they're wrong. I think they're wrong at a number of levels. I think they're wrong because, first of all, the issues are inherently linked. The richer you are, the higher your emissions. The poorer you are, either as a household or a community or a country, the more vulnerable you are to climate action. And to one of your points there, most climate actions in and of themselves have regressive impacts, which isn't a reason not to do them. We have to do them. But you have to do them eyes wide open to that and committed to mitigating it. And so back when I was still with the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives, we did lots of that modeling of what does it look like to construct a carbon tax with a dividend or credit in some form, that you can transform what would otherwise be a regressive tax and turn it into a progressive tax. But I actually think it goes deeper than all of this. I think we need to link climate action and inequality because that's how we win. And on the flip side, one of the key lessons from my study of Second World War mobilization is that inequality itself is toxic to the social solidarity you need for mass mobilization in the face of a crisis. When I shared with friends that I was writing this book and that it had this World War II frame, you know, often people would say, oh, well, back then we were a much more cohesive society and that made it easier. And that's not true. you know, if you look at the famous Piketty U shape, right? Looking at the share of income to the 1%, what's so interesting there is it's at its peak, whether it's Canada or the UK or the US, it's at its peak in the decades just before World War II. And then you get that 30-year period after the war where there's more equality, and then it starts to go up again. In fact, in Canada's case, the single year in which that share of income to the top 1% is at its peak in the last 100 years is 1938, the year before we declared war. So we did not go into the war a cohesive society. That social solidarity was forged in the exercise of doing that grand thing together. And I also, you know, there is this, again, this is Canadian, but I think there's parallels with the States. In the early years of recruitment and mobilization in Canada, you know, the propaganda from the government was very kind of unnuanced and, you know, it was just, you know, go get Hitler. That worked to a point, but only to a point. And what they realized as of about 1941 is that if they were going to truly mobilize society, if they were going to hit the recruitment numbers that they needed to hit, they had to engage the public in a conversation about what kind of society they were going to return to. Canada's first major
income transfer programs came in during the war. Unemployment insurance in 1940, the family allowance in 1944. This famous Marsh Report, which was this groundbreaking government report that really lays the architecture for the whole modern Canadian welfare state, was written during the war and offered up to Canadians as a promise and a pledge that the society they would come back to would look different than the one they were leaving behind. That's when they start to get the recruitment numbers. That's when the full society-wide mobilization starts to happen. And this, I think, has its parallel in the appeal of the Green New Deal today, which is, if you really want to get everyone on the bus, it can't just be about tackling GHG emissions. It has to be about marrying that with something bold and ambitious on inequality as well. That's how you get everyone on the bus.
So paint us a picture. I just talked to Justin Trudeau and my other friends at the top of the government and got you appointed as the emergency mobilization energy czar. What does the plan look like?
Well, I come back to my four markers, right? This is how you go into emergency mode. You spend what it takes to win. You create new economic institutions to get the job done. You move to mandatory measures as required, and you tell the truth. So let me take those in reverse order. For Canada, telling the truth means you stop lying and telling people that we can both take climate action and double down on fossil fuel expansion, when in fact you can't make the math work. In Canada, Justin Trudeau's government, a year ago last summer, passed a climate emergency motion in the House of Commons one day, and the very next day reapproved the expansion of the Trans Mountain Pipeline that brings bitumen from Alberta into my province of British Columbia. So this is the mixed messaging that we get now, and we didn't get mixed messaging like that in the war. In terms of moving to mandatory, what I mean is you would set firm, clear, near-term dates where you would say the selling of new fossil fuel-burning vehicles will be banned as of 2025. You would say no new buildings can tie into natural gas for space and water heating as of next year, right? That's how you start to communicate that it's actually an emergency. In terms of creating new economic institutions, this is where, you know, I really had some fun with the book. The whole transformation of, when it comes to military production during the war, Canada, from a base of almost nothing before the war, really accomplished something incredible. We ended up building the fourth largest air force in the world. We built about 700 ships, you know, what you got, most, about half of which were what the Americans called Liberty ships. We called them Victory ships. We built 800,000 military vehicles, more than Germany, Italy, and Japan combined, you know, and we were all from a population of 11 million. Now, how was that done? It was all overseen by this minister for munitions and supply named C.D. Howe, who was an American by birth. He was an engineer. He had trained at MIT before moving to Canada. He was a private sector guy. He'd made a lot of money in the private sector, building grain elevators before going into politics. But he just became seized with this task. He was happy to give contracts to the private sector, but anytime they couldn't quickly do what needed to be done, he created a new public enterprise, what we call Crown Corporations. He created 28 Crown Corporations during the war. In contrast, Justin Trudeau has created two, one of which is the Trans Mountain Pipeline Corporation. So we need to do that again. We need to do what he did, do an inventory of how many heat pumps are we going to need, how many electric buses, how many solar arrays, how many wind turbines, what's our current production capacity, how do we fill the gap? What's the role of a new generation of Crown Corporations to expedite filling that gap and producing and deploying all of those goods at the requisite scale? And then the final part is you spend what it takes. Government spending in the war in Canada increased tenfold. In this pandemic, by the way, Canada's debt to GDP ratio is increasing from about 35% to 50% this year. But we came out of World War II with a debt to GDP ratio more than double that. And when C.D. Howe was pressed about all of the spending that was occurring under his watch, he famously replied, "If we lose the war, nothing will matter." That's how you know when a government's in emergency mode.
So your focus on the history is on your homeland. It's on Canada. But many people would say Canada can do the right thing, and you're usually better at it than the United States. As how would I say, based on me being a witness from Detroit looking across the river. But I guess in a global context, is there some kind of inhibition to action? You talked about, I think, what you called in the book and on podcasts, an appeasement politics with the fossil fuel industry. But is there also a kind of sense in which, with America acting like it's acted, with what's going on in the challenges of development in India, and coal burning and what have you, that, in other words, what's the point of doing this in Canada when we don't see everybody mobilized alongside us? And you might say you set the example, inspire others and bring them along, but I'm just curious how you react to what might call those despondent arguments.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's some merit to those arguments. One of the lessons of a study of the Second World War is that you don't win world wars by yourself. You win them with allies. Mm-hmm. And that will be true again today. But it's also true that each of us are responsible for our own governments. And so what I've been telling people as I've been talking about the book Across Canada is we have to get our house in order and, as you say, set a good example. We are among the largest producers of this stuff, and so we have an important role to play. But in the end, we have to hit the IPCC targets for our country and do so knowing that millions of other people of goodwill are engaged in the same struggle in their countries with their governments. And, you know, does it require a leap of faith that we each do what we have to in our countries and hope that our allies in other countries will also succeed? Of course it does. But that's what we have to do anyway. We have to stop appeasing, as you say, the fossil fuel industry, and that's a kind of metaphor that I use in the book, because so much of our climate policy still seeks to appease these companies. In fact, we invite them onto our climate advisory committees with federal and provincial governments, which at this late hour I think is madness. You know, any climate policy that seeks to have these companies find comfort in them isn't a climate policy worth having at this late hour.
Do you, how would I say, do you find any invigoration from the victory of Joe Biden in the sense that international collaboration rather than nationalist hostility and embracing the issue space of climate will make it more likely that people will band together and rise to the challenge?
Absolutely. A Biden win in the States is a huge help for us in Canada, because there's no doubt that for a lot of Canadians, their thinking was, you know, it was sort of a defeatist feeling that, oh, well, even if we did everything, what does it mean if the Americans are going backwards under Trump? So to have that, you know, dynamic mercifully come to an end is a big help. And also, the U.S. now moves from being, you know, slow relative to Canada to jumping ahead of us. When I mentioned those four markers that I did, right? Spend what it takes, create new institutions, move to mandatory, and tell the truth. Biden actually starts to hit a number of them, particularly the first one and the last one, in a way that Justin Trudeau isn't. So that is helpful. But also, I just want to come back to your other question for a second around that feeling like what will it all amount to in the end? Because here, too, I take some solace from the World War II story. We live in a very ambiguous time, as I was saying before. All of us are wrestling with this question. Can we actually do this at the speed and scale required in time? And the honest answer to that question is, we don't know. But, you know, in what this, the historic memory I'm trying to present here in the Canadian context, but you have your parallel in the United States, from a population of 11 million people, over 1 million Canadians enlisted. I mean, that is a remarkable figure. But what we often forget, and this is particularly true in Canada, less so in the United States, is what those 1 million-plus people didn't know is if they would win. Particularly before, in the years before the U.S. and Soviet Union joined, hundreds of thousands of Canadians enlisted during those early years when it was very much an open question as to who would win. And they did it anyway. And they surprised themselves in the process. And that's the spirit I think we need today.
So the, how would I say, I'm kind of curious, having known your sister for some time, you get a book like This Changes Everything. And as an economist, I was just kind of spellbound because she was essentially talking about what you might call the shattering of the coherence of neoliberalism in light of this change, and that the resistance would be formidable. I remember talking to her once over a lunch where she said to me that it's not that they don't agree with climate science, is that they think it sets a precedent for government intervention in everything. Mm-hmm. So they're going to stake out a war on this pole to prevent other things. Well, eventually, people like David Fenton, the well-known publicist and environmentalist, and he started seeing people on the right, people like Grover Norquist, becoming frightened because they saw what you might call the scenarios of climate deterioration perhaps leading to an anxiety that would invite an authoritarian response. In other words, if you don't address it proactively out of despair, people will ultimately see the government as failing, and you'll have a less, what I will call, liberal or decentralized form of government. And yeah. I think we're, it's what's tricky about climate, and this is really the nature of my question, is that people don't feel it like they feel an armada of bombers dropping things on the city. In other words, the opposition in the war is more tangible. We're pretty confident in our scientists, but we're not, at least until recent years, people were saying, when's it coming, as opposed to it's right upon us.
Yeah. Well, there's a few different things in what you're saying. So first of all, let's start with your last point there. And often, again, when I told people I was working on this book, people would say, oh, well, back then everyone understood the threat to be clear and present. And they don't get that with climate. So there is some truth to that, in the sense that, you know, the curse of climate relative to the war and relative to the pandemic is that it moves in slow motion. And that allows for all of us to delay what we need to do, and allows governments to kick the can down the road. But the fact, you know, in the rearview mirror, many of us assume that, you know, our countries got the threat of the Nazi threat and the World War II threat right away, and everyone was on board. And that is decidedly not true. You know, you mentioned the bombs falling from the sky. So if you lived in Europe or in London in the early years of the war, yeah, it was clear and present. But for those of us in Canada and the United States, it was not a clear and present danger. It was on the other side of two oceans. And, you know, when Canada declared war in 1939, It was a half-hearted declaration. The public was not all on board. And in the United States, a clear majority did not support joining the war. It took 2 years of hard work and leadership. And the media played an important role. The, you know, Edward R. Murrow and the crew at CBS News played an instrumental role in shifting U.S. public opinion, so that by the time Pearl Harbor happened 2 years later, there had been about a 20 percentage point shift. But that's the parallel, right? The threat wasn't clear and present to Canadians and Americans in 1939. It took a combination of events and leadership to get them there. So in, you know, in Canada, the first 9 months of the war are famously called the phony war by historians, because we declared war, but not much happened. And then 9 months later, the fall of France happens. And then there's a shift in the zeitgeist. People start to realize, oh man, this is for real. And in the pandemic, you know, for a lot of people, you could imagine, you can try to remember what it was, right? Like, for a lot of people, it was the cancellation of the NBA season. Like, I don't even watch basketball, but I remember thinking, oh man, this must be serious. But it also took seeing our prime minister give a press conference every morning outside of his home to communicate that this was an emergency. And that's the moment we find ourselves in now. What's the combination of events like extreme weather events, and you've certainly had your share of those, and leadership that results in people moving from seeing the climate threat as sometime off in the future somewhere else to here and now? The good news, and this I can say in the Canadian context from polling I actually commissioned for the book, is that a huge shift in public opinion has already occurred over the last 2 to 3 years, where we are now at the point that a majority of Canadians sees climate as an emergency, and the threat is here and now. And that wouldn't have been true as recently as 4 years ago.
And what you might call a large mobilization for an economic project of transforming the energy sector on both supply and demand side in a period of what you might call fragile economy might also be good news, not unlike a Keynesian stimulus was in right. The times of Franklin Roosevelt.
Well, in the same way that the New Deal in your case and the war in our case was the economic recovery out of the Depression, a truly ambitious climate plan and a Green New Deal can be just what the economy needs post-COVID. But we're starting from a difficult place. Like, we're starting from a point where, first of all, too much of the conversation has been dominated by the individualization of solutions. We're approaching them as consumers, as opposed to understanding that this requires a state-led effort to actually transform the economy. And so that sets us back. And we're also held back by the fact that in both of our countries, the basic level of climate literacy is appalling. In one Canadian poll I saw, only about half the population correctly understands the main source of global warming to be the combusting of fossil fuels. And so you end up with very contradictory polling results. You can have a majority of the public saying, yes, climate's an emergency and we want bold action, and support expansion of the oil sands. Now, how can the very same people hold those two disparate views? Well, you can hold those two disparate views if your climate literacy is as low as it is. And that too speaks to a leadership challenge. And again, both of our countries had both public institutions and the media, including the private media, who rose to that challenge, who did that education, who shifted public opinion, as I say, in the lead up and during the early years of the war. And they're not doing that yet when it comes to climate.
Yeah, I'll quote, years ago, George Soros gave a series of speeches in Budapest. He calls them the Budapest Lectures. And he talked about, in a world of uncertainty, one has to, and he was a student of Karl Popper, that one has to grapple with uncertainty, and he called that the cognitive function. But he thought the other dimension that Popper hadn't discussed that was very dangerous was what he said was the manipulative function, which is instead of approaching the study of the world in order to place yourself in a better place from what you learn, people use the transmission of false information in order to paint pictures to get you to act in a way that will make them better off. And that signal-to-noise ratio, what, again, I'll refer to merchants of doubt and all, and in the context of an uncertainty that's on the horizon and not a tangible threat, people can really wreak havoc with that, like they did with the tobacco industry for many years.
Yes. Well, and that moment of great anxiety, too, can go either way. And, of course, people's economic insecurity can give birth to something as promising as the New Deal and as destructive as the Third Reich. The one good news, in at least in the Canadian polling, is, like, for a long time, I think we felt like, well, we were being held back by straight up climate denialism and all of the, you know, the money that the merchants of doubt have plowed into this campaign. The good news in the Canadian polling is that those who straight up deny climate change are a diminishing rump of public opinion. I actually think they're not our biggest problem anymore. And that our bigger problem, at least, is this dynamic that I call the new climate denialism, which is our political leaders and industry leaders who say they get the science, but who continue to practice a policy agenda that doesn't align with what the science says we have to do. And that's really epitomizes the Justin Trudeau federal government and most of our provincial governments.
Well, Seth, after talking to you again today and knowing you and your sister, I'm tempted to want to commission a book on the history of how did your mom and dad raise two such fabulous public servants, minds, and courageous people. I want to pay tribute to both of them. I understand your father's a physician, isn't that right?
And
your mom was a political activist, I remember hearing.
Well, she's best known in Canada as a documentary filmmaker.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Alex Gibney actually is the one who told me about that. But I think, this is such a stressful time. And, you know, you were talking about people with kind of take the information where they want to go. I'm always reminded of the kind of poet and stand-up act who calls himself In Q, which stands for In Question. And he has a famous saying from about 2013, people will always find the information to support what they want to believe. Mm-hmm. In other words, that notion of fear or aspiration or whatever is can be nourished by truth, but it can be nourished by false consciousness as well. Mm. And what I see, in both you and your sister is that you really plant your feet and you do things which are a very quiet leadership. And we're in this uncertain times where I was bringing this within Q is that people have a yearning to hear things. And at that intersection, call it the fork in the road, between hope and despondency. Despondency is the fuel to the fire of a resumption of authoritarian rule, in the case of America, or the growth of authoritarian rule in other places. And that notion that you bring to the conscious level, trusting in government, the four pieces of an essential framework, is you're creating a vision, you're creating a horizon for how to do this and take the daunting fear of, big thinking, not being enough, and going to big action. And I think that's the kind of medicine people need right now.
You know, I want to come back to something I was trying to say near the beginning. I did not appreciate this when I first landed on this World War II frame. But it is this useful framework for engaging all kinds of new audiences, and in particular, some conservative audiences, because it is a truth in both of our countries that, conservatives tend to approach things in individualistic terms. And yet an awful lot of conservatives get very animated about the Second World War. That's why our Netflix streams and bookstore shelves are completely filled with World War II reboots. and the curious thing is, though, of course, that the war, like rising to the climate emergency, are inherently collective projects, even though many of the people who get so excited about it are normally such individualistic people. And what I love about talking about the book now is that whether or not you are a conservative or a liberal or a New Democrat, a social democrat in Canada, or a business person or a labor person or a farmer or an engineer or an architect, you've got a connection to this history and people you admire from that history. And this is this opening to say, yeah, and who do you want to be today? And maybe I can leave you with this. It's sort of a thought that I leave people with at the end of the book. All of these people who get all excited, who watch all of these World War II Netflix series and read all these World War II books, when they go to bed at night and they turn off the movie or put the book down, there's a question, I think, in their heads. And the question is, what would I have done if I had lived then and there? And what I'm trying to say in the book is your children's future is again cast into doubt. And a civilizational threat is again at our doorstep. So the answer to that question is whatever you're ready to do now.
Well, many of my conservative friends characterize things as what you might call a struggle between chaos and order or stability, and they affirm the latter, and sometimes that creates a nostalgic orientation. So by going to a history book, you brought them closer. But what I think is interesting is that the thing you're saying is there is potential for an order out there to overcome climate change, but it's a different order. We need a transformation of how we meet this challenge from our recent customs of behavior, and we've got to go to the place that is analogous.
Well, what you call order, I would say, is economic planning. I mean, this is the thing about C.D. Howe. Not only did he create 28 new public enterprises for Canada to do this wartime production, and again, there's an echo of this in the pandemic. He carefully coordinated all the key supply chains. So all the inputs, the key military inputs, machine tools, rubber, silk, oil, coal, timber, he appointed controllers for each of those sectors who carefully coordinated those supply chains and ensured that military production was prioritized. But this is a key lesson out of it, is that the private sector had a big role to play, and a lot of people made a lot of money, but they didn't leave the allocation of scarce resources to the market, because in an emergency, that's not what you do.
And he was an American, wasn't he?
And he was an American, yeah.
Yeah, going up to Canada and doing the right thing in collective action. That's an interesting tale unto itself. Well, thank you very much, Seth. This was, been an inspiring and beautiful conversation, and again, thank you for embracing this challenge, writing this book, and giving people something to look forward to across the political spectrum. This is quite an accomplishment.
Thanks, Rob.
Let's go around the corner, get into next year, and maybe we'll have another episode talk again. And I'm certainly going to try to advocate once this pandemic is over for you to do more than an electronic book tour.
Sounds good.
Great. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And check out more from the Institute for New Economic Thinking at ineteconomics.org.
And I'll tell it and speak it and think it and breathe it. And reflect from the mountains so all souls can see it. And I'll stand on the ocean until I start sinking. But I'll know my song well before I start singing.